Friday, October 15. Is that correct? Yeah. And we're still in chapter 11, and nothing is showing up on the overheads because the video went to sleep. And do we have that now? We're actually on overhead number 4 in chapter 11. And we're going to quickly review that again because we went very quickly through that. And we don't want to miss it. So we're talking about cofactors and coenzymes. Let's take a look at the ones near the bottom, the 7s and 8s. Because I was yelling at you at the end, inactive enzyme missing only the cofactor is called an apoenzyme. So it's all the proteinaceous substances that are there minus the cofactors, but typically it's inactive. And notice how cofactors are classified. Cofactors are actually classified as both metal ions and coenzymes. So coenzymes are ever so slightly different than cofactors. Cofactors include non-organic materials, such as these metal ions and so on. The coenzyme itself can be then broken down into two additional groups. Co-substrates, which means there is some sort of attraction or adhesion of the cofactor to the protein, but there's no covalent bond. And what you find with prosthetic groups, it may be very similar in structure, but a prosthetic group is actually covalently bonded to the protein. That makes it a prosthetic group. So when you look at the variety of coenzymes, and this is a pretty comprehensive list, there may be others that are on here. I mean, there may be others, but these will do just fine for what we're going to do in this class. You can see here that almost all of them are related somehow in a vitamin, as a vitamin. Biotin, pentathenate, cobalamin, riboflavin, nicotinamide or niacin, peroxidine, pyridoxine, B6, folic acid, thiamine, B1. So many of the cofactors have their origin as vitamins. You take a look at some of these, of course, if there is a deficiency, they end up having a deficiency disease. For example, we know that if you're missing cobalamin, which is vitamin B12, that will give you pernicious anemia as a symptom. Niacin deficiency will give you pellagra as a cluster of symptoms for that particular disease. And my favorite here in terms of how they name the disease is thiamine. If you have low levels of thiamine, you get beriberi. And again, all these are nutritional diseases that can be almost immediately ameliorated by the application of the appropriate vitamin. Of course, there's one that's not listed here. It doesn't act as a coenzyme. It acts actually as an oxidizing reducing agent. But that's vitamin C. Vitamin C. And of course, a human deficiency for that gives you scurvy. But it doesn't actually classify as a coenzyme. Then you see here that they actually have a specific classification of reactions that they actually perform. In other words, that these particular compounds perform their function in a variety of enzymes. So if you have, for example, an enzyme that has the coenzyme nicotinamide has an NADH or NADPH as a part of it, you're always going to be going through oxidation reduction type reactions. Thiamines do aldehyde transfer, for example. And I'm not going to go through the details of this. But biocytin here, the biotin vitamin source, carboxylation, this has a lot to do with the synthesis and breakdown during carbohydrate digestion and synthesis, carbohydrate metabolism. So you see a lot of biotin or biocytin-related enzymes because a carbon dioxide either has been released or has been attached to something else, and the intermediate form of that carbon dioxide is typically attached to the enzyme through the cofactor or through the coenzyme biocytin. The other one that's interesting to me is this one right here. Tetrahydrofolate comes from folic acid with the megaloblastic anemia. This is especially relevant for women of childbearing age because loss of folic acid or deficiency of folic acid can have detrimental effects to the unborn child. There is a disease or a symptom, I guess it's a disease, called spina bifida. Spina bifida. And all of what that spina bifida is there, the neural tube, you know, goes along the back here, and there are the developmental times in which the vertebrae and the skin close over it to form the tube, because it was just laying there in a kind of a channel. Spina bifida is where that doesn't close. Extreme forms of that provide, now I've forgotten the name of it, but it's when there is a severe absence of brain tissue in the brain. Literally, the baby is born without a brain. It's not aborted because there's enough of a brain stem to keep the body alive, but there's no higher order functions at all. There never can be. So that is an extreme form that you might find of folic acid deficiency. There are other reasons why that might occur, but folic acid deficiency is one of them. So if you're going to get pregnant, you want to get pregnant, plan to get pregnant, the family, the husband and wife begin, not the husband so much, but the wife begins to take some folic acid on a regular basis to make sure she's replete with folic acid. Folic acid is a water-soluble vitamin, and therefore you have a tough time getting too much because it will be excreted in the urine pretty readily. So I've not heard of a folic acid excess. Some of these others you can. Cobalamin, vitamin B12, that is one of the vitamins that you use the least. We're talking about nanogram quantities on a daily basis. And typically what you find here is with the cobalamin or vitamin B12, there is a requirement for an animal source of some sort. In other words, that plants don't make vitamin B12. And if you're a strict vegan, you have to be careful about getting vitamin B12. You can be a strict vegan for several years before you would notice any kind of vitamin B deficiency, vitamin 12, B12 deficiency, because you have a large storage amount of it in your body and you use so little of it, every day. But what people do are vegans that need to have the vitamin B12, yeast, certain types of yeast will make vitamin B12. And so you can put yeast flavoring on some of your vegan materials and get your vitamin B12 from that. If you're a non-meat eater but you're lacto-ovo-vegetarian where you eat cheese and milk, no problem. Plenty of vitamin B12 in cheese, milk, yogurt, all kinds of good stuff like that. Yes?
I heard on some that the vitamin B12 deficiency can also affect your memory.
Uh-huh. I don't know the exact mechanism. Nope. It is interesting how a deficiency in one area can really cause unusual symptoms in another. It's not obvious. That's what happens because we are greater than the sum of our parts. We can't always see the direct interrelation. But no, I've not heard that. But I don't know why either. Yes.
People with sickle cell anemia, do they take
I've not heard that vitamin B12 is helpful for sickle cell anemia. That doesn't mean it does. It's not. There's not some research out there, but I've not heard of it. There are other vitamins that they. What is it? Niacin. That might be a part of that, or thiamine. I've heard that they take that, but I don't know the mechanism even for that taking for that part of it. You can spend your entire life studying vitamins, and it's a fascinating thing. The other thing is, vitamin B12 is that it has to have a carrier. Your body secretes a carrier into the digestive tract that captures it and pulls it in. Older people begin to have reduced secretion of that carrier. And so older people can be eating plenty of food and still have a vitamin B12 deficiency. And so older people who are lacking that carrier protein that decreases due to age, they get vitamin B12 shots once every year, once every 2 years, and they're just fine. Works out just really swell. So a fascinating thing. We're going to be seeing more of these. I will point them out to you, especially when we get into the actual mechanism of the a glycolytic pathway. There's a bunch of these in a glycolytic pathway and citric acid cycle. It's outstandingly interesting. Okay, let's go ahead. Now, what do enzymes do, ladies and gentlemen? What do enzymes do? Well, you got here, this is just in general, we're looking at the idea of catalysis. It's actually a rate enhancement. You can see here where you have a free energy of an ordinary uncatalyzed reaction where you have HAB reacting with C, and there's that transitional state in which you have a temporary structure, a species, that both has structures similar to HA and HB and also HBHC. That intermediate structure requires energy to obtain that structure. It's a unique transitional state structure. And eventually the energy is released as the new bond is formed and old bonds are broken. Now this is kind of an unusual diagram indicating there's no net gain or loss in the free energy. Here's a much more common free energy reaction in which A and B yield the transition state species called X. It's at a high energy, and then there's the reaction product that actually produces P and Q. You have the net free energy of the reaction. In this case, this is an exothermic reaction. And you have that delta G that's got that telephone pole. That, of course, is the free energy of activation. The free energy of activation. How much energy it takes to create that intermediate species. If we go down then on the lower right-hand graph, you see here that we've got a situation where, again, we're comparing these two, the top graph and the bottom graph, and you see the result of catalysis. Catalysis, of course, creates a new intermediate structure, which creates a new pathway. And many times this new pathway takes less energy to form, and therefore the energy of activation, that initial hump, is smaller. And therefore, there's a greater likelihood, based on the thermal energy in the system, that you're going to have a higher proportion of reactants make that transitional intermediate and then be able to go on to the final products. Notice what a catalyst does not do. The catalyst does not change the overall delta G of the reaction. An exothermic reaction producing 10 kilojoules per mole with or without a catalyst will still produce 10 kilojoules per mole. The rate of the reaction will probably be greater when it's catalyzed, and that's the intent of it, because it creates a new pathway with a lower energy of activation. Again, the delta G says nothing about the rate of the reaction. The delta G has nothing to do say about the rate of the reaction, the kinetics of it, only about whether it's favorable or unfavorable. Here we have now, on the lower left-hand corner of overhead number 5, we see where A is going through an intermediate I and finally producing the product P. What they're illustrating here is two different reaction pathways and something known as the rate-determining step. Unfortunately, unless you've printed this out, this is all in black and white, and for that I'm sorry. Let's follow, if you would, the lower one first, at least the first hump that's lower. If you follow along that lower hump in the A reaction then goes down to I and then becomes the higher hump where it has I telephone pole to follow that. So the lower hump becomes the higher hump on the second intermediate, as it were. So if we base it on that, you can see here that as you follow along, A going to I, and then I going to P for the red line, you'll see that the step between I and P, it has the higher activation energy, and therefore is the rate-determining step. So the lesson to be learned there is, with a multi-step process, the step that has the highest activation energy is going to be the rate-determining step. Even though within, as far as you are detecting, you have an A reactant and a P product, if there's multiple intermediate steps, any time within those multiple intermediate steps, one of those steps has the highest activation energy, that's going to be the rate-determining step. If you use the blue line here, or the line that's highest at the A telephone pole and lowest at the I telephone pole, then you'll see the step between A and I, the unisolated intermediate, that would have the rate-determining step in this particular reaction. So that's a truism, whether we're talking about an enzyme reaction in which a single enzyme reaction in which there's multiple intermediate steps, or if you're talking about a pathway in which there are individual enzymes in that pathway. Anytime the enzyme is either the slowest or has the highest activation energy, that's going to be the rate-determining step for that entire pathway. Let's see what else. Again, as I said here, the changing of the activation energy does nothing about the overall net exothermic, endothermic nature of the reaction, does not tell us whether it's going to be more favorable, less favorable, doesn't change the favorability at all or the spontaneity of it, simply changes the ultimate rate of it. If it's unfavorable, it'll be faster unfavorable if there's a catalyst. All right, so let's go ahead here and take a look at some things. Catalytic mechanisms. That is, how at the atomic molecular level, at the detail, at the electron shifting level, what happens? How have we classified enzymes? Are there classifications we can use to help us understand how enzymes behave? Yes, there are a variety of types of mechanisms. The first type is called acid-base. Another type is called covalent. Covalent mechanism is one in which at some point in the mechanism, the substrate is covalently attached temporarily to the enzyme. Metal ion, not surprisingly, there's a metal ion involved. Many times it's zinc, magnesium perhaps, iron. Proximity and orientation effects. Now, D, proximity and orientation effects, actually is a mechanism that applies to virtually all enzymes. So whether you're a covalent, acid-base, metal ion, proximity orientation effects apply to that particular mechanism, no matter what other happens. And finally, on E, preferential binding of the transition state complex. That's a very powerful idea and has direct application to drug manufacturers, in which you take a compound and you make that compound into a particular shape that targets the transition state structure of the enzyme you're trying to inhibit. So you have a target enzyme that you want to inhibit. You look at it rationally. You look at the structure. You begin to try to evaluate where how the mechanism fits, how the transition state looks like for between the reactants and the products, then you create a molecule that fits that transition state. Typically, it binds very powerfully, sometimes even irreversibly, but when it happens, you are able to lock up, to occupy that enzyme, prevent its activity, and might be able to slow down a disease state or shift the body to use a different mechanism that perhaps enhances or ameliorates a disease symptom. Anyway, there's a variety of things. We're going to first take a look at general acid-base catalyst. The A line here is the non-catalyzed form. This is simply a ketoenol transition as a model for what happens for acid-base reactions, acid-base catalyzed reactions. So you see here with the quinolinated tautomerism, there's a shifting of electrons onto the carbon-carbon bond here, and shifting of electrons from the carbon onto the oxygen. You have this transition state intermediate, and then there's a shifting of hydrogens, and you get the enol form of it. Ketoenol tautomerism, as it were, is what this is. This occurs relatively slowly, as it were, however, in the absence of acids or extra acids and bases. However, when you go on and you look at using the acid-catalyzed mechanism, partial proton transfer from acid lowers the energy of activation. If you see here, the transition state is different than the original transition state or uncatalyzed transition state. Because the transition state is different, there's a different pathway. In this case, this pathway actually lowers the energy barrier between keto and enol forms. So the presence of the acid supports the movement of the electrons onto the oxygen and thus makes the breaking of the hydrogen here easier and the shifting, breaking of the hydrogen bond here easier. The hydrogen then that's now attached to the oxygen is different than the one that was originally attached to the methyl group, and so you find that that's obviously going to make things occur quicker because of a different pathway. Lastly, here you have a base that helps extract that hydrogen. And then, of course, with that hydrogen there on that base, other hydrogens in the solution then can attach that oxygen, and you now have a situation where you've again created a different pathway and lowered the energy of activation and enhanced its activity. So base-catalyzed, acid-catalyzed. I'm not going to ask you to memorize this particular figure. Simply understand that acid-base additions and subtractions to mechanisms can create a new transition state. I want you to pay attention to the example we're going to show you here in a little bit. Some mechanisms use both simultaneously, and these are called concerted acid-base catalyzed reactions. Concerted is the word. Concerted. Let's go on, shall we? Now, one of the most common mechanisms that uses this acid-base catalysis is called RNAase. Now, I've not listed anything here as terms of what figure this is. This is a figure in chapter 12. It's one of the earlier figures. There's a very nice caption with it. I would suggest that you read the caption and follow along the process that they're using here as an example of how acid-base catalysis can speed the chemical reaction. If you notice here, apparently, you've got two histidines in the active site. The RNA is this black form that's coming in here. How can you tell that's RNA as opposed to DNA without if they didn't label it? How could you tell it's RNA as opposed to DNA if they didn't label it? They have the same base here. And there's a base there indicating it's some sort of nucleic acid. And someone said it. What was it? There's the 2-hydroxy group. Now, where are we talking about? Right there. The 2-hydroxy group on that sugar. If that's not there, what compound are you dealing with? DNA. So if that oxygen is not there and there's simply 2 hydrogens, that's the DNA. That's the only difference between the two. But notice what happens here. Because there's a hydroxy there, suddenly that hydroxy group becomes is an attack point for 2 histidines. Now this is interesting. Remember the pKa of histidine? Remember what the pKa of histidine side chain was? 6-something. That's exactly right. That was kind of the more unusual one, wasn't it? Because it was a nitrogen-containing side chain that had an acidic pKa. None of the other side chains that had nitrogen have an acidic pKa. It's aromatic. So, I mean, there's an organic chemistry reason why, but biochemically it's interesting for that reason. Notice that because of the particular environment and the pKa being close to 7, this histidine, the 2 histidines here, are both acting as both a base and an acid. This particular one has an extra hydrogen that it can lend to absorb some electrons. This nitrogen here acts as a base to extract that, the hydrogen ion there, the electrons move over here, these electrons shift down here, and you have a situation where you lose part of the chain that's been cleaved, that gets broken there, and you have a cyclic structure there temporarily. Water comes in to break that cyclic phosphate, and it restores the original acid-base content. So here you have both an acid and a base acting in concert to enhance the catalytic activity. And, of course, what the whole idea of a catalyst is at the end of it, it has the same structure as it did at the beginning of the chemical reaction. And that's exactly what happens here. And notice the RNA is now cleaved. Voila, acid-base. So you might want to be able to discuss intelligently this particular example of acid-base processes in catalysis. Now, we have a bunch of other ones. There's covalent catalysis, and we'll be looking at that in a little bit. This is a temporary covalent bond, speeds the chemical reaction. Typically, you'll find this with nucleophilic catalysis. It kind of stunned me, honestly, when you look in your textbook, they have a beautiful picture of SN2 reaction mechanism. Now, what does SN2 stand for? What's the capital S stand for? Substitution, yes. SN2, what does the N stand for? And what does the 2 stand for? Yeah, it's bimolecular. There's two going on there. SN2. So the nucleophile, of course, has extra electrons that it can attack the, quote, positively charged nucleus, the nucleophile, nucleus loving. Now, what you typically have to have some sort of nucleophilic catalysis, of course, you've got to have a good nucleophile and a good leaving group. There are three steps, of course. The nucleophile and substrate bond, the withdrawal of the electron from the reaction center, and the removal of the catalysis is how that works here. Let's take a look at some of these. Here are some very common nucleophiles. You got this, side chain, what is that? What's the functional group there? Alcohol. What's the functional group here? And the functional group here, of course, is amino. And here's, look at that. There's that histidine or imidazole group. What do you know? Now then, let's quickly run through this. What side chain has alcohol group on it? Alcohol, not hydroxy, not phenol, but alcohol. What is it? Serine and also, there's another one, threonine. Threonine, that's exactly right. Now, just to remind you, I had you memorize the side chains of the amino acids, did I not? Yes. And you will find, as you are right now, that I don't have to plow through that and tell you that again. All right, so justification, first time for memorizing the side chains. There you go. So, now, you will discover very quickly, there are catalysis, enzyme catalysis, dependent on the presence of a serine. Because that serine has that hydroxy group on it. We'll be going through that this chapter. Now, so you got these nucleophilic forms that they're, lots of extra electrons and so on. You have electrophiles, protons, lots of metal ions, carbonyl groups sometimes, this cationic imine. So a shift base is typically what biochemists call that carbon double-bonded nitrogen, a shift base. You recognize it from your organic chemistry as a what? Imine, shift base. This place, anytime you're dealing with nitrogen and you're shifting nitrogen atoms around, there are imines and shift bases all over the place in the mechanism. It's really fantastic. It's just, anyway. All right, so what's going on here? Well, let's see here. You're trying to go. Let's see, what are we doing here? You're taking acetyl. What's happening here is you are trying to create this, you're trying to go from acetoacetate to acetone. Acetoacetate to acetone. And they're showing a couple different mechanisms here. One of them is simply a spontaneous rearrangement of acetoacetate to and a loss of carbon dioxide to make acetone. Acetoacetate and acetone are also known as... I'm being so mean. These are known as ketone bodies. And ketone bodies play an important role in diabetic acidosis. Diabetic ketoacidosis. And I'm pointing at you. That's not fair. But at any rate, there's a third one that's here. But we'll get to that when we get to fatty acid oxidations and stuff. But these two are known as ketone bodies. They're basically fat-soluble, water-soluble fat equivalents. Water-soluble fat equivalents. Acetoacetate is actually biochemically produced, and in the body it will spontaneously form into acetone. Anybody? Have you had a diabetic incident in which you haven't? Okay, they caught it early enough. You sometimes find people who are comatose from having a diabetic reaction due to lack of insulin. If you get close to their mouth and try to tell if they're breathing, and if they're breathing, that smells sweet, and it smells sweet because it smells like acetone. Everybody who's going to be in organic chemistry goes, that doesn't smell sweet. That's acetone. Oh man, we got to get some insulin. Okay, guys, got going through insulin shock or diabetic reaction. So ketone bodies, high levels of this. So, but what you can do is there are mechanisms that do this enzymatically. And notice this R group, the nitrogen group, can actually be bound through one of the side chains like lysine and then bind through that. Notice that R group. That R group means the rest of the enzyme temporarily reacts with that, releases hydroxy, makes that imine. There's some shifting around. The acetone is released, and the protein is restored to its original state. That's just an example of how the shift base or imine can act as a different pathway to get to a final product. And this would be a catalytic system or situation. All right, now, metal ion catalyst. This is not all that interesting, but it does have... three factors that metal ions do for catalysts. They help bind it in the proper orientation, because metal ions are invariably what charge, ladies and gentlemen? Metal ions are what charge? Positive. They shift, basically they shift, help hold or move electrons. So they do redox states between different cofactors and substrates. And finally, they're stabilizing and shielding negative charges in that might be created during the catalytic state or catalytic mechanism. Here is what you find. This particular side chain. Notice how the zinc is being held in place by a bunch of what? Histidines. Now look, there's a threonine. Oh, wow, how does all work? Anyway, so the zinc is held in place by that, with all these histidines. But notice what this is. This is a, let's see here, carbonic anhydrase. So the zinc holds a hydroxy group in place. In comes a carbon dioxide. That oxygen then, because of the influence of the zinc, is a strong nucleophile, attacks that carbon dioxide backside, and then it creates this intermediate that can be attacked by water, and that restores the original hydroxy group on the zinc and produces hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. That's the carbonic anhydrase. And so this carbonic anhydrase, you remember what happened in the first overhead? Let's see here. Oh, look at carbonic anhydrase. What was the rate enhancement over non-catalyzed form? Nearly 8 million more, is that correct? Yeah, and that's because of the presence of that zinc. there. Presence of the zinc. Let me see if I can get back to where we want to go to quickly without having to go through all this other stuff. Okay, so good example, carbonic anhydrase, zinc. Boom, 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 carbonic anhydrase. All right, let's go ahead, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? Proximity and orientation effects. Now, I said proximity and orientation effects apply to every enzyme. What did I just say? Proximity and orientation effects do what? Apply to every enzyme. Enzymes enhance reaction rates. In part, they do this by simply bringing substrates and catalytic sites close together. Simply helping them get close together due to some sort of mutual attraction between the enzyme and the substrate, that increases the rate by 5 times. Bind the various substrates in proper orientation, that increases it another 100 times. There may be charged groups within the active site that help stabilize the transition state, keep it from wandering around. And finally, eliminating various motions, translational and rotational substrates and catalytic sites. That typically accounts for nearly a 10 million fold increase in the chemical rates. We are so used to thinking macroscopically that what you discover is that at the solution level, at the molecular level, it's complete chaos. If you were to look at a solution of some fairly complicated, sugar, let's say glucose 6-phosphate, hexokinase, and the proper conditions, the hexokinase is constantly under thermal attack by the heat, by the thermal energy of the water. And that hexokinase is not fixed in place so nicely like we see in a picture, but it's tumbling and rotating and vibrating and... Right? Translational means what? It's being moved like Brownian movement. Rotational means it's spinning. And not just in one axis, but in multiple axes. And the substrate, the sugar, is doing the exact same thing. It's being moved by Brownian movement. It's tumbling. Okay? In all three axes. And at 37 degrees... that's not cold. That's pretty warm. And there's lots of thermal energy rotating it. So here's an example of this. Now, this table is not in your text, right? But I found it a very elegant example of the relative rates of anhydrite formation of esters possessing different degrees of motional freedom in the reaction. So here you have, you've got this one ester here. You've got this other ester here. And notice what they've made. This is an anhydride functional group. Is that correct? Is that how you describe it? Well, what happens if you simply allow these two compounds to have all 3 degrees of freedom and have both translational and rotational freedom? Well, they arbitrarily and capriciously called that rate constant 1. The next thing they did is they connected these together through 1, 2, 3 carbons, in which there's free rotation around that carbon and free rotation around that carbon-carbon bond. So these things are going like this. Like this. But immediately, notice they're not in three-dimensionality. So they are literally forced to be in the same region that immediately increases it by... at 1,000. Then they reduce the degrees of freedom again, so it's just, they're just rotating like this. And again, it increases it an additional amount. And finally, they lock the two, within this ring form, they lock the two esters in the ideal position for attack to make the ester. And notice what happens to the rate. That's 10 million or 50 million times greater than just the two as two separate ones. So the lesson to be learned from this graph is that if an enzyme can trap the substrates, reduce the rotational and translational freedom, immediately you have a rate increase. Immediately you have a rate increase. And so and not only because of the proximity bringing them close together, but also because of the transitional and rotational degrees of freedom that are lost. All right, well, that's interesting. Now, one last step is the catalysis by preferential binding of the transition state. That's what TS stands for. As a substrate binds into the active site of an enzyme, the active site conformation changes to fit the substrate better. The substrate conformation changes to mimic the transition state. So both the enzyme and the substrate conformation changes. Conformation changes. And so again, these proteins, these enzymes are not fixed in space like a picture. They're being jostled about and they have some... They're just sitting there, just kind of molten globular state, if you know what I'm talking about. They're not locked into some sort of position. They have a lot of flexibility in it. For an instant, the active site binds the ideal transition state very strongly. The catalysis increases sharply because the concentration of the transition state species is now relatively high. The binding of the substrate and the binding to the enzyme and the enzyme conforming to the transition state and the transition and the substrate transforming the transition state immediately increases the percentage or a concentration of the transition state. All right, so we'll get done with this. Now, this simply comes from shaking hands. Okay, now shake your hand. Now, what I want you to do, notice what he's got. No, I want you to know. I want him to lock. Notice how he approaches it like this. I want him to lock his hand in that position. Okay? I'm going to lock my substrate in there. Now, is that a very good handshake? Is there a tight binding to this? No. Okay. But in this is an exact analogy to what's happening with the enzyme, that's you, and me, the substrate. And so as we come in, you conform to me, I conform to you, and we have a nice tight binding. Now hold that shape, and I'm going to hold my shape, and let's let go. So notice now what this is the transition state. And by binding and having the shape of this active site have the same transition state and forcing my substrate in that same transition state, I increase the amount of transition state significantly and increase the rate. Now, you're an errant enzyme. I am a new multi-million dollar drug. Okay? And we're going to shake hands again. Now then, what happens is I'm automatically shaped as a transition state. Okay? I'm the transition state shape. So I come in here and I lock into him. And I don't let go. And now he's inhibited. And now the patient has better symptoms because this enzyme is not working. All right? So that's how drugs can become important. Drugs that have the transition state shape can become important and powerful inhibitors of enzymes that can... that if they are inhibited, can ameliorate disease symptoms. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll talk more on Monday.
Almighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing.
Our strength confide, our
be. Christ Jesus, it is He, the Lord of hosts, His name, from age to age the same. And He must win. We will not fear for God.